From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as promised, we bring Arthur Alexander back to talk about his songs, his life, and his return to music after 20 years. And we'll compare his versions of his songs with the versions recorded by the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. Also today, the politics of adoption. We talk with Elizabeth Barthollet. She's a professor at Harvard Law School and the mother of three children, two of whom she adopted in Peru. And critic Maureen Carrigan assesses the changes at CBS. If you haven't heard, Connie Chung's joining Dan Rather at the Evening News Anchor Desk. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton came to the Capitol today to shore up support for his economic program. House leaders, meanwhile, predicted the package would be approved in that chamber next week. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Conservative and moderate Democrats are worried that despite the plan's $246 billion in new taxes, the deficit may still go up because of automatic spending increases in entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare. President Clinton said today he shares those concerns, but that capping entitlements, as lawmakers have proposed, is not the way to go.
I want controls on health care. I am very much open to that, but it ought to be part of our overall health care strategy. That's the best for the American economy.
House Speaker Thomas Foley indicated after today's meeting that conservative Democrats would not be allowed to try to amend the plan when it reaches the House floor next week. He said chances for the plan's passage were very good. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
The Clinton administration fired all seven members of the White House travel office today amid allegations of mismanagement and careless accounting. The workers, all of whom had been on the White House payroll for at least 10 years, were ordered to clean out their desks by the end of the day. White House spokesman Dee Dee Myers said the FBI has been asked to investigate the office, which coordinates commercial travel for White House staffers and charters planes for the White House press corps. Myers said the dismissals came after a private accounting firm found there was almost no documentation of the money handled by the offices and that other records were inadequate. Two Palestinians were killed in the West Bank today, and an Israeli soldier stabbed by Palestinians last week died of his wounds. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
According to the army spokesman, the two Palestinians ran into an empty house when they were surprised by an army patrol in the West Bank town of Hebron. The army believed they were on Israel's wanted list, and soldiers fired anti-tank weapons at the house. When the men tried to jump from a window, soldiers shot and killed them. The Israeli soldier who died today was an Ethiopian immigrant. He was one of two soldiers injured by Palestinians last week in Nablus. In the past few days, there has been an upsurge in violence in the occupied territories. Yesterday, troops shot dead two Palestinians in the Jabalia refugee camp in Gaza. Palestinian negotiators say the violence and the continuing closure of the occupied territories is turning popular opinion against the Middle East peace process. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Aviation officials in Colombia say that a passenger jet with 125 passengers and 9 crew members on board crashed today in the mountains east of Medellin. The Boeing 727 was on a flight from Panama to Bogota. Local radio reports said that helicopters have been sent out to search for the wreckage. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 55 points today. This is NPR News. A new report suggests that a tainted blood scandal in Canada may have affected more people than previously thought. About 1,000 Canadians are known to have contracted the AIDS virus because of a contaminated blood supply during the 1980s. Now, the government is being urged to locate hundreds more who may have the virus and not know it. Jennifer Ludden reports.
The draft parliamentary report, leaked to journalists, is the government's first formal response to Canada's tainted blood scandal. In the mid-1980s, the Canadian Blood Supply Agency continued to use untreated and untested blood for nearly a year after being warned the supply could be contaminated with the virus that causes AIDS. Since the details of the scandal broke last fall, activists have urged that criminal charges be laid against blood system officials, similar to charges laid in France. This week's parliamentary report calls for a public inquiry into the scandal, something Canada's health minister and the Canadian Red Cross say is not necessary. The report also criticizes the blood supply system for not tracing all those who could have been infected by the scandal. It urges a comprehensive nationwide testing program. For National Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Ludden in Montreal.
Voters in Pennsylvania have overwhelmingly rejected a proposal to pay bonuses to state residents who are veterans of the Persian Gulf War. 65% of those who voted yesterday rejected a proposal to authorize $25 million in bonds to pay bonuses to the state's 33,000 veterans. Pennsylvania is the home of the 14th Quartermaster Regiment, which lost 13 members in a Scud missile attack on their barracks in Saudi Arabia. Mary Rhodes, who was injured in that attack, told the Associated Press that many people in America don't regard Desert Storm as a war. The proposal would also have built a $1.5 million memorial to veterans of all wars. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A couple of weeks ago, we presented a live concert with singer and songwriter Arthur Alexander. The concert was great, but there was hardly time to talk, so we made him promise to come back for an interview, the interview you're about to hear. Arthur Alexander is performing again after a nearly 20-year absence from the music scene. He's been living in Cleveland, driving a bus for a community center. Elektra Records recently coaxed him back into the studio. His new album, Lonely Just Like Me, reunites him with some of the musicians he recorded with in the 60s from Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and Memphis.
There was a little girl I had planned to marry. This was my love. I didn't want to share it. I thought that love would make my life bright and sunny. She said she couldn't love me cause I didn't have no money. So every day I have to cry some. Every day I have to cry some. Dry the water from my eyes some. Every day I have to cry.
Arthur Alexander started recording in the early 60s in Alabama. He had some R&B hits in the States. In England, his fans included the Beatles, who recorded his song Anna, and the Rolling Stones, who did his song You Better Move On. Let's compare both versions of You Better Move On.
You asked me to give up the hand of the girl I love. You tell me I'm not the man she's worthy of.
You ask me to give up the hand of the girl I love. You tell me I'm not the man she's worthy of.
Arthur Alexander, do you remember the first time you heard the Rolling Stones version of your song?
I sure do.
When was it, and what did you think?
It was back in 62, I think, or 63. The record had been out for quite some time before I heard it. But when I did hear it, well, I thought, you know, it's a great, you know, a great tribute, you know, and follow-up to what I had done. And looked like, you know, he was following me as close as he could, you know. And he didn't sound bad, you know.
Were you surprised how famous they became?
I sure was.
Now, your version of You Better Move On, this was one of the first sessions that was cut at the Muscle Shoals studio, the Fame studio in Alabama. And it became one of the most famous Southern Soul studios. I think featured on that very first session at Muscle Shoals, in which you made You Better Move On, were some of the same musicians on your new record.
That's right.
Donnie Fritz, Spooner Oldham.
That's right.
Now, how did you come to make the first record at that now famous studio?
Tom Stafford, which you may have heard or you may not have heard of, he was sort of the catalyst for everybody, you know, including Rick Hall, who produced the record. And his father had a drugstore. And above the drugstore, he had a studio. And all the musicians from miles around, you know, they would gather there in that studio, you know, that Tom had. And how I came to cut You Better Move On at Fame, before then, we'd done a song called Sally Sue Brown, and which it didn't do well. And then I wrote You Better Move On. And I took it to Tom and Rick, and they liked it. And they came to the conclusion that the studio that we had previously recorded Sally Sue Brown in was not adequate because it was only 2-track. So we moved up to 4-track, Ampex. And Rick went out and rented a tobacco barn in Muscle Shoals. And me, Donnie, and Spooner, and everybody, we went out and we burlapped the walls. We put egg crates around it. We coned it, you know, for the sound. And we went to work trying to record You Better Move On.
So it's really a historic session, both for you and for the studio.
That's right.
Now, on the flip side of You Better Move On was another one of your songs called A Shot of Rhythm and Blues.
Right.
Now, I want to play it. Because I think the beginning is going to sound familiar even to people who don't know the recording. And then we'll segue into the reason why.
Well, if your hands stop it, fire! Well, she was just...
Did the Beatles get that opening lick off of your record?
Well, you would think so, you know. I wouldn't go as far as to say that they did, but you know, by listening to it, you know, you get a pretty good similarity, you know, to both records there. So I would, you know, if they did it, you know, it wouldn't be nothing irregular because during that time, a lot of people copied a lot of people, including me. I copied a lot of people.
Who'd you copy?
Well, I copied Brooke Benton on Sally Sue Brown, a lick that he had on Kitty-O, you know?
Uh-huh. Now, on the same record that the Beatles used that opening from, I Saw Her Standing There, they covered your song, Anna. Now, I want to play your version of Anna and then the Beatles' cover of your song, Anna. We'll play them back to back.
Anna, me, girl, to set you free, girl. Anna, you come and ask me, girl, to set you free, girl.
That's John Lennon singing Arthur Alexander's song, Anna, and we open with Arthur Alexander's recording of his song, which, of course, came first. Arthur, your reaction when you heard the Beatles?
Oh, I was really high on that, you know. I couldn't believe it because, see, at the time I heard it, the Beatles were selling records like hotcakes, you know. And the fact that they had recorded my song, I was totally elated, you know. I heard the cash register ringing, you know.
Well, you heard it ringing, but you never got the money, as you explained to us during our concert.
No, I never got the money, but I heard it. I heard it ringing, though. You know, I could hear it. You know, and yeah, I was, you know, like totally elated. You know, until I found out that I wasn't going to get the money.
And you didn't get it because?
Because the publisher didn't pay me.
Uh-huh.
See, I made a deal with the publisher. You know, I didn't have a publishing company, and so a song has to be published. So you have to have a publisher. So I made a deal with the publishing company that published the song. And they were in turn supposed to pay me half of the money that they got from the song. And they never lived up to their end of the bargain. They never paid me.
Did you ever sue them?
Yeah, I tried, you know. Matter of fact, the case is still going on some publishers, you know.
Hmm. Now, the two songs that we both heard, You Better Move On and Anna, have a very similar theme, two men in love with one woman. I have to think that these songs probably had something to do with your own experiences.
They certainly did. They certainly did.
So what was your story?
Well, You Better Move On was was a real life trauma between, you know, this girl that I had met out of high school and the guy that she had been going with all through grade school, you know. And I met her out of high school, and I thought we had a pretty good thing going. And since he'd been going with her through grade school and everything, he evidently thought he had the best hand. And so I put my feelings in the song. I never confronted him personally, but in song, you know, I did, you know, because that's the way I felt. And everybody knew that this is what was happening because people in the street, you know, they would tickle you, you know, about how's the relationship going. You know, they would ask me, and I'm sure they would ask him, you know. But I won out that little deal there.
So what was the outcome?
The outcome was I married her.
Uh-huh.
I married the girl. And the girl was Anna.
Her name was Anna.
Right.
So how long were you married?
We were married, I believe 8 years. Yeah. And then we were, separated. And, we really didn't get a divorce, I think, until like 74.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're real good friends.
Let's get back to your singing. So you made your first record upstairs from the drugstore. Your second record was the first record that was ever made at the Muscle Shoals studio in Alabama. But you didn't stay there, did you?
No.
How come?
Tom Stafford was my manager, and he and Rick, you know, they had a falling out, and Tom wanted to move to Nashville because Dot Records had expressed an interest in signing us, and he wanted to pursue that.
So, did you go to Nashville?
Yes.
Nashville is, you know, the capital of country music. You were always interested in country, and I mean, you're credited with one of the people who started singing a kind of fusion of country music and soul music. But how did you do in Nashville?
I was started off doing quite well in Nashville. You know, I recorded Anna in Nashville. I recorded Go Home Girl in Nashville. And I recorded several other songs that I was pleased with. But after a while, you know, it became, everything got caught up in a business type of thing. And I don't think we were recording as good of songs as we should have been, you know, for my career.
Would they give you stuff you didn't like?
Well, they would, to give you an example, after You Better Move On hit and they needed an album, they picked a bunch of songs that was currently already out, you know, and said, we need this album, you know, and let's record this, you know, and these songs and put out an album. And I felt that we should have waited, you know, and tested the waters, you know, give me a chance to write a few more songs or look around for some songs that was original, because the songs that we recorded had already been recorded by other people and were already hits by other people. And so that took a lot away from my album, you know, right there.
Was there anyone who watched out for you when you were getting started?
Well, Tom Stafford, but he became...
He's the one who ran the studio, the Muscle Shoals studio.
He's the one that had the studio above the drugstore.
Right, I'm sorry, right.
Yeah. So, I mean, he was looking out for me at first, but then he got caught up in a bunch of stuff himself, so... He couldn't even really look out for himself. So he wound up, you know, making a lot of bad deals for me and for himself.
Mm-hmm.
And but he was the one that got me started in the business, and he was the one that my loyalty was with. So I instinctively knew a lot of times that, you know, what he was doing wasn't quite right, but I credit him, you know, with getting my career off the ground, and so I followed him, I think, through a lot of bad relationships, you know, or business deals that maybe I shouldn't have consented to.
Singer and songwriter Arthur Alexander is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Arthur Alexander. Bring us back to the period of the early 60s when you started to perform nationally. What kinds of places were you playing?
When I first started off, I was playing like dance halls, you know, and then it progressed down to, you know, what they call like the Chitlin' Circuit, you know, the one-nighter deals where you go out on the road on the bus, you know, and you play this joint this night, then you drive 500 miles and you play another joint, and you do that for like 2 or 3 weeks, you know, until you just you just wore out, you know,
mm-hmm.
And you have no recollection of those places, you know, once you travel on a bus, you know, for 500 miles. Each way, you go on the stage, and then you get back on the bus, and you drive another 500 miles, and then you're lucky if you got time to wash up and change clothes and go on stage.
There was a period when you were playing a lot of the R&B shows, and I know one of your songs, Johnny Heartbreak, was recorded by Otis Redding, who was a friend of yours.
Right.
Now, from what I read, it sounded like you were supposed to tour with him on his last tour, the tour in which he was killed in the plane crash.
That's right, I was. I mean, you know, I had my plane ticket and everything, you know, and we had talked, you know, and Otis had said, he wanted me to open the show for him. And he sent me the plane ticket. I was supposed to meet him in Atlanta. But the night I was supposed to leave Alabama, it was a big fog there, and no planes were taking off, and no planes were landing. So I missed the connection in Atlanta. So I called him, and he said, "Well, man, I got to leave, you know. So I'll have the ticket rewrote, and you can join me, you know, a week later, and it'll be, you know, basically the same thing." But a week later, he was dead. He had, you know, died in a plane crash.
Would you have been with him on that plane had you made your plane?
I probably would have. I probably would have been. Matter of fact, if I'd have made my plane, it's probably no doubt I would have been there. But I take that as, you know, as a blessing and a sign from God. I don't think he wanted me on that plane, you know.
You left performing after your recording of Every Day I Have to Cry. Now, this was a song you wrote earlier in your career. Steve Alemo had a hit with it in the 60s. You recorded it in 75. That, I think, reached the top 40 or top 50. But not too long after that, you left the recording industry. You explained to us during your concert that had a lot to do with the way you were treated in the music industry, the fact that you didn't make money for some of your songs, that you weren't treated well, bad business deals. Were there personal reasons, too, why you wanted to get out?
Well, the main reason, you know, after I recorded Every Day I Have to Cry, and it reached, you know, it was top 40 in 75, and I was informed that I wasn't going to be paid, you know. That was just the last straw, you know. You got a top 40 record, you know, and you're not going to make any money, then, hey, I mean, what are you in it for, you know? I mean, how can you go on after that, you know? So I just said, well, you know, forget it, you know. I'd rather pump gas, do anything, you know, than keep making records and not, you know, not get paid.
when you left music, you found God. But did you miss music?
I mean, well, I had music with me all the time. I sang in church.
Uh-huh.
Every Sunday I could, I was up there, you know, with the choir. I was singing my heart out. You know, I had programs. And, hey, I was loving what I was doing. I was singing for God, and he was putting melodies in my heart and my mind, and my spirit was flowing, you know, and I was feeling good. And I wanted to stay there. But, you know, but when you face the truth, you have to go back and straighten out all the little things in your life that you left that was wrong, you know. And I had some things that I had to go back and deal with. And God moved me on from there to Cleveland.
What was in Cleveland that you had to deal with?
I had a daughter and a girlfriend who I later married in Cleveland. And I had to get that together. So I was off to do that. And that freed me up, you know, more, you know, because I felt I was doing the right thing. And I was doing the right thing. And I had two kids that I had by Anna, and they were growing up. So when I got to Cleveland and got a job, I sent for them. And I brought my whole family together. And then we had another kid. and we kept growing, you know. So there you have it.
And you supported them with your job driving a bus for a community center.
That's right.
Were you writing songs during the period when you weren't performing? And if not, when did the first new song come to you?
The first new song. Wow. Well, the first new song came to me like 2 years before I'd done the session, which was I Believe in Miracles. And that song just, you know, that was really played heavy on the decision to go back in the studio, because I believe God wanted me to go back in just to do that song, because, you know, it played so heavy, you know, on my mind. Because I'd be driving the bus and I'd find myself singing that song, you know, before I even knew it was a song. You know, I'd just be singing, you know. And I said, wow, you know, I don't remember writing this song before. And then I said, wow, this is a new song. So, I think 2 years before I'd done the session.
Well, I'm really glad we had this chance to talk. Because as I said, when we did the concert, the only frustration was that there wasn't nearly enough time to hear your story. So thanks so much for being with us again. And I wish you the best with your new performing career and your new record.
Hey, thank you. Thank you very much.
Arthur Alexander's new album, his first in close to 20 years, is called Lonely Just Like Me. He starts a summer concert tour June 20th at the Central Park Summer Stage in Manhattan. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Till I make it on my own, I'll cry, but I'll get by, and I'll forgive you, girl, by and by, and I'll forget you someday if it's really gotta be this way.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, why the adoption system often leaves children without parents and would-be parents without children. We talk with Elizabeth Barthollet. She was a single woman in her 40s when she adopted two children from Peru. Barthollet is a professor at Harvard Law School and the author of a new book on the politics of adoption. And critic Maureen Carrigan considers the pairing of Dan Rather and Connie Chung. Is it good news for women? Is it good for the news? That's all coming up on Fresh Air. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton was on Capitol Hill again this morning talking to fellow Democrats about his deficit-cutting proposals. Mr. Clinton said that he feels good about the plan and feels that it will be approved by Congress. While the president was meeting with Democratic congressional leaders, Ross Perot was just down the hall meeting with freshman Republicans. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Flanked by smiling Republicans, Perot emerged from the meeting and attacked everything from the president's economic program to his health care reform plan to his lack of focus. Perot called Mr. Clinton's proposal for a deficit-cutting trust fund a hat trick that wasn't fooling the American people, and he borrowed the Republicans' rhetoric to denounce the president's budget.
It's tax and spend. That's not what the American people want. The American people want to, if they will pay more taxes in a fair, equitable way, to balance the budget, pay down the debt, and leave a strong country for their children.
Perot also blasted the president for filling political appointments too slowly, and he criticized the Congress's seniority rules, which he said don't give new members a voice. The freshman House members with him strongly agreed. I'm Andy Bowers at the Capitol.
In Bosnia, a self-proclaimed Serb parliament has declared a UN-sponsored peace plan dead after voters over the weekend turned it down. The plan calls for dividing Bosnia into 10 separate provinces. The assembly had already rejected the plan and said that 96% of those voting in the weekend referendum opposed the agreement, and 96% voted to form their own state instead of Bosnia. The plan, drafted by diplomats Cyrus Vance and David Owen, would give three zones to each of the warring factions. Ministers of the Western European Union meeting in Italy have reaffirmed support for the Vance-Owen peace plan for Bosnia. As Francis Kennedy reports from Rome, the European Defense Alliance also considered a Russian proposal for a phased-in implementation of the plan.
The official declaration confirmed the commitment of the European Defense Alliance to seeking a political solution, but no options, even military ones, were ruled out. The Secretary General, Mr. Wim van Eekelen, said the creation of safe havens was a priority, and these could be especially useful if the Vance-Owen plan was eventually approved. The Russian plan, put forward by Foreign Minister Kozyrev for a phased implementation, was considered positively, though some members felt it was too soft on the Serbs. Ministers here are playing down any reports of a rift between Europe and the United States, which sees airstrikes as a necessary measure to combat Serb aggression in Bosnia. For National Public Radio, I'm Frances Kennedy in Rome.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 55 points to close at a new high of 3,500.03. There was heavy trading of more than 340 million shares. This is NPR News. In Denmark, a number of people were wounded when rioting broke out last night after voters approved an agreement for European unity. Violence in Copenhagen was termed the most serious confrontation with anti-government protesters in years. At one point, some 300 demonstrators used material from a nearby construction site to try to block a main street in the capital. Police fired tear gas and charged with riot shields and dogs. In running battles, demonstrators set fires and broke bank and shop windows. Police said that shots were fired when rocks and metal bars were thrown at them. Some trouble has been reported again tonight in Copenhagen. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has begun consideration of Roberta Achtenberg, a San Francisco County supervisor and lesbian, to be the nation's top fair housing official. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Actonberg is being opposed by conservative Republicans on two counts. As a board member of the United Way of the San Francisco Bay Area, she voted to deny funding to the Boy Scouts because the organization discriminates against gays. That led Mississippi Republican Trent Lott to charge Actonberg with intolerance.
Is she tolerant of the views of others? Can she administer her duties fairly and without bias? Or will she be a militant extremist promoting a narrow special interest agenda?
North Carolina Republican Jesse Helms said he opposes Actonberg because she would be the first lesbian confirmed to a top job in the government. But Actonberg's supporters say her nomination should rest solely on her qualifications. A vote on Actonberg's nomination will be delayed until Friday. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the Capitol.
The government says that the nation's trade deficit climbed to more than $10 billion in March as consumers bought more oil and foreign cars. The Commerce Department says it was the worst showing in nearly 4 years, with an increase of more than 29% in the trade gap. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Anyone who wants to adopt a child is usually warned they'll have a hard time getting a baby. My guest, Elizabeth Barthollet, is the author of the new book Family Bonds, on the politics of adoption, a subject she knows about from personal experience and from her work as a professor at Harvard Law School. She gave birth to a boy when she was married and in her 20s, but when she was in her 30s and single, she wanted to have another baby and found out her IUD had left her infertile. After years of infertility treatment, she decided to adopt. But the obstacles she faced adopting in America led her to consider foreign adoption. When she was 45, as her birth son was leaving for out-of-town college, she flew down to Peru to adopt a baby. 2 years later, she returned and adopted another son.
Part of why I didn't look into adoption as early as I might have is that I wasn't even certain that as a single person I could adopt. And when I did first look into it, I found a variety of very typical discouraging messages that it would be incredibly difficult, that the typical agencies wouldn't take me or would put me at the bottom of the list or would only let me adopt a much, much older child. So those were discouraging early messages. But I found that once I decided I was going to do it, once I quit the treatment road and threw myself into it, that it's like any other thing you throw yourself into, you can pretty quickly find out how it works. And I think one of the important messages about adoption is that unlike infertility treatment, you can achieve your goal. If you set out to be a parent, you can become a parent. Whereas with infertility treatment, there's really no control you exert over what in fact is going to happen. And in fact, for most people, they're not going to succeed in producing the pregnancy thereafter.
Now, you teach law at Harvard Law School.
I do.
But you write that in the adoption world, you experienced the law as something that prevented good things from happening. What were the laws that you just couldn't comprehend that were standing in your way?
Well, first, as an overall matter, the way the law structures adoption is to set up barriers. The barriers are there supposedly in the, quote, best interest of children. But in fact, all the laws are designed really to make adoption difficult. They're based on the premise that something is likely to go wrong when a child is turned over from one parent to another for the purpose of raising. And that's my first and major problem with the law. The next thing I discovered was that something very surprising to me as a civil rights lawyer. As a civil rights lawyer, I had discovered that the world largely, at least on an official basis, prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, age, disability, and to a significant degree, marital status. Now, in the adoption world, it is exactly those factors that are the primary determinants of who's allowed to parent and which child they are allowed to be matched up with if they are found minimally fit for parenting.
How did you rate as a potential parent? You were in your 40s, you were single, you had a great profession.
Bottom of the barrel. For the first time in my life, I discovered that my credentials were lousy. I was really not the absolute bottom of the barrel. Gays and lesbians, of course, are often, usually in this country, found not even to cross that minimal fitness threshold. People with very serious disabilities would be below me, but a single person in her 40s is very low.
You adopted your first baby in 1985, and this was in Peru.
Mm-hmm.
And you write about the odd dilemmas of choice that you face in adoption. I don't know if this is particularly true in international adoption. But for instance, you were called up and you were told, well, you could have this baby, they're a few months old.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to decide, well, do I want this baby or do I want to wait for another baby? What went through your mind when you got that phone call?
I think that the choice involved in adoption can feel quite agonizing, and it certainly did to me. It's uncomfortable. It doesn't feel the way it ought to be. There's something much easier about being pregnant and knowing that just this is the child that you were meant to have. So that choice is uncomfortable. On the other hand, I think that the element of choice in adoption is incredibly important, and the fact that all adoptive parents are consciously intending parents seems to me a very important thing. And indeed, it's a major reason I think the agencies should get out of the business of parental screening altogether. I think adoptive parents are, on the whole, very good bets as parents, and better bets than biologic parents, half of whom probably didn't start as conscious intending parents.
Well, did you accept the baby that was a few months old?
Yes, that's my Christopher.
Once you got to Peru and accepted this baby, then you were told, well, we have a brand new infant we can exchange for the son that you've accepted. What a kind of bizarre thing, I suppose, to have to deal with.
Well, I was actually told when I first got to Peru that there were two children. I met Christopher, the slightly older child, first. And I, think in a matter of some number of moments that it on some emotional level became clear to me that that was my child.
How did you tell?
I didn't have some moment at which I knew, I suppose, until I met the infant that very same night and realized that I had already bonded to Christopher and that he was my child and that I couldn't take this infant.
How old was Christopher?
He was 4 months.
Once you decided, that Christopher was your son, then you had to live through what you describe as the peculiar form of torture reserved for foreign adoptive parents. What were some of the bureaucratic things in Peru and in the States that you had to go through?
Well, in the States, it's easier, of course, because whatever absurdities you have to go through, you're here, you live in your house, you have your friends, you go to your job. What's difficult abroad, I spent 2.5 months roughly with each adoption. What's difficult there is a couple of things. One is that you don't know the system and you don't have any of your supports around. I was entirely alone in Lima, except for the friends that I made there. The most difficult thing, though, is that you don't know, and this is true usually with foreign adoptions when you're in the foreign country, you don't know until the end of the process whether you'll be able to finalize the adoption and bring the child home, so that although in the first moments or the first hours or the first days you feel emotionally that you have completely become the parent of this child, you live for whatever period of time it is with this extraordinary anxiety that for any or no reason someone may simply lift this child and take it away. That's what really makes it overwhelming. The rest of it, the terrorist blackouts, the dealing with the police doctor medical exams and the psychiatric interviews in a foreign language you hardly understand, those things can be very difficult. Certainly the medical crises that I lived through were extraordinarily difficult, medical crises that my children lived through. But I think the worst of it is this anxiety that you may lose this child.
Let's take a short break here, then we'll talk some more. My guest is Elizabeth Barthollet. She's a professor at Harvard Law School and author of the new book, Family Bonds, Adoption and the Politics of Parenting. This is Fresh Air. Elizabeth Barthollet is my guest. She's written a new book about adoption and the politics of parenting. It's called Family Bonds. So both of your adopted sons are Peruvian. Now, in America, there's a lot of resistance to interracial adoption. And some of that resistance comes from African-American groups who think that if black children are adopted by white parents, that the children will lose their heritage and identity. For example, the National Association of Black Social Workers opposes interracial adoption. They say it robs black children of their heritage and racial identity. As the head of an interracial family now, what do you think?
Well, it may be predictable, but I believe in transracial and transnational families. I think it's one of the exciting things about adoptive families is that they cross all sorts of barriers, birth heritage barriers, as well as racial, national, and cultural barriers. My own sense is that the position of the black social workers is a position that's very harmful to the black children in this country who are waiting for adoptive homes.
Do you have, like, numbers, you know, the percentage of black children versus white children who don't get placed?
Sure. First of all, we have about 500,000 children now in foster care in this country, and about half of that number are children of color. The children of color wait much longer for placement, and they wait for longer period of time, even if they are eventually placed. We've got, I mean, the reason why current racial matching policies cause such problems for black children is that there's an incredible mismatch in the numbers here. We've got half the kids waiting for homes are children of color, and yet perhaps 90% or even more of the prospective parents waiting are white. There have been a lot of efforts in the last couple of decades to provide subsidies to African American children to adopt same race children and to reach out and to recruit. None of those efforts have even begun to produce the number of African American parents that we need. And it's not because African Americans don't want to adopt, it's because there's such a mismatch in the numbers. If you have half the kids in the system, kids of color, we just are not a nation with a population where half the prospective parents or anything like it are people of color.
You actually oppose matching in general in adoption agencies, you know, where the agency matches the potential parent and the child. If matching were done away with, what would the system be like?
I would hope what we'd then have is agencies that were putting their resources into getting the children who need homes together with the people who want to parent. And that seems to me the business that agencies should be in. I think they're both wasting their resources now and putting up tremendous barriers that prevent children from getting homes. And I don't think they're even accomplishing much of what they would like to think they're accomplishing. I mean, take, for example, the case of gay and lesbian prospective parents. They are officially excluded from adoption all over this country. I mean, they can slip through, but they're officially excluded by most agencies throughout the country. And yet, lesbian couples particularly are adopting at a rapid rate. Mostly, they're going through the system purporting to be straight singles, and the system is sufficiently limited in its resources and energy that it doesn't go out and investigate individuals or couples to find out what actually is their sexual orientation. So we have gays and lesbians adopting anyway. We also have a system that is pushing gays and lesbians into producing their own children through donor insemination, for example, where there's absolutely no barrier, no screening, no problem whatsoever.
But getting back to what the system would be like if the adoption agencies didn't match parents to kids, would the parents just come in and choose somebody? I mean, how would it work?
Yeah, they'd come in and get in line. I mean, I would let birth parents and prospective adoptive parents have choices and exert choices and decide I'd let adoptive parents decide what kind of child they want to adopt and feel comfortable adopting. I'd have let the agencies, indeed, I'd encourage the agencies to provide advice, to encourage adoptive parents to do lots of soul searching. I'd encourage lots of education and counseling by the agencies. Indeed, I think that the agencies could do a lot better job on guiding parents toward the kind of child it makes sense for them to adopt if they would get out of the business of screening. In other words, if they'd give up their power and just put themselves in the education business, you would then have prospective parents who'd be willing to be honest with the agencies. Right now, prospective parents just think in terms of getting a good score on their home study, so they don't engage in the kind of open soul searching that I think is important for people who are entering into adoption.
You've been quoted in a couple of recent articles about cases in which the birth parent won back custody of a child from the adoptive parent. Mm-hmm. You've been quoted as saying that you think that we value biology over nurturing, and that that's not right. We need to place more value on the amount of nurturing a parent has done.
I think that theme is really at the core of almost everything in the book. It's true. I do think that in general in our society, we define parenting too much in terms of biology, and I think that has to do with why people dealing with infertility struggle so long and so hard to overcome infertility rather than moving on to adopt. I think it's why people thinking about parenting generally don't consider adoption to be one of the options that they think about, rather than just naturally thinking automatically of creating their own biologic product. And I certainly think if you look at the whole process of children who were separated from their birth parents, and whether we sever that bond legally and free them up for adoption, that we value biology too much. And my concern there largely is that we don't value the child's interest in a nurturing home nearly enough. I think we should value that first. And then I think when we think of parental rights, we shouldn't think just of the right to procreate. I think there should be a right to adopt, but I think that for both adoptive and procreating parents, we should think of parenting as more of a privilege than a right.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Barthollet is a professor at Harvard Law School and author of the new book, Family Bonds. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing about President Clinton and his battle with the Congress to get his economic program through. Also, we'll be hearing about what's happening in Bosnia and also about the roots of Serbian nationalism. Also, a talk with Rita Dove, poet and professor at the University of Virginia, the new poet laureate. We'll hear what she intends to do with the position of poet laureate. You know, it's really up to the occupant of the job every year to decide what to do in the job. She says she'd like to try to make poetry more accessible during her term. And Linda Wertheimer talks with an author about the experience of menopause. It turns out in her case to, at least in the relating of it, be a rather funny one.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. On Monday, CBS made the historic announcement that beginning June 1st, Dan Rather will be sharing the anchor desk with Connie Chung. Chung is only the second woman ever to be a TV network news anchor. Barbara Walters briefly anchored ABC News in the 70s. Chung's appointment, according to network executives, is an attempt to change the dynamic of the all-male network evening newscasts. But commentator Maureen Corrigan says that the new news looks a lot like the old news to her.
If you didn't know better, you would have thought the photo in yesterday's New York Times was of a mature, just married couple. The camera caught him, jowls a-tremble, planting a big wet smooch on her cheek. She looked radiant in her pastel suit. In the front page story the Washington Post ran, even the headline read like a wedding announcement. CBS pairs Chung with Dan Rather. Who cares about Charles and Di? Finally, we Americans have an arranged royal marriage of our own that we can obsess over every weekday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The union of Chung and Rather is major news because of the symbolic role our network anchors play. Presidents come and go, but most anchors carry on for decades, conducting the nightly ritual of explaining the world to America and America to itself. Never mind that in the 1950s, Walter Cronkite hosted a cheesy game show called It's News to Me. Once he became an anchor, he became a demigod. With few exceptions, the post has been held by lone white males. So the anointing of Chung signals the country's readiness for an updated self-image, one that's more ethnically diverse, less sexist. We know this is true because the anchors have already told us so. Reformed macho man, rather, confessed it was time to share. And Chung thanks CBS executives' wives for raising their husbands' consciousness. But I suspect that what's being touted as a feminist partnership is nothing but the same old, same old. Rather praised his new co-anchor by saying, quote, "Connie is Miss Congeniality." Imagine McNeil saying that about Lair. Rather still gets top billing, he'll still make a million more than Chung, and he plans to globetrot while Chung keeps house behind the anchor desk. To me, the joining of Chung and Rather is motivated not so much by progressive social ideals as by the network's need to normalize Dan Rather by linking him with a likable, beautiful woman. If you've caught that classic Marlene Dietrich movie, The Scarlet Empress, currently running on cable, you know this is a centuries-old strategy. Dietrich plays the teenaged Catherine the Great, who's married off to the insane heir to the Russian throne in order to save the monarchy. Likewise, CBS's regal stature has been shaken by Dan's outbreaks of oddness. His claim in 1986 that he was mugged by a man chanting, "Kenneth, what's the frequency?" and his walkout just before a broadcast in 1987. And last year, I and other Dan fans observed an on-air Humbert Humbert flirtation with young health reporter Edie Magnus. Forget wild palms. The CBS Evening News has to be the strangest show around. The early signs are not good that the union with Chung will straighten Dan out. On Monday, he excitedly told reporters that CBS will be offering the new news, more modern, more exciting, and more relevant. Whatever happened to the quaint equation of the news with the facts? And why, to borrow comedian Tracy Ullman's insight into the royal family, do we pay these people, these mere news readers, so much just to be better than us? As we await the debut of The New News, I've got one word of advice for Connie Chung. Courage.
Marian Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis and Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our program was directed today by Naomi Person. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Anne Lamott. Her new book, Operating Instructions, about the first year of her son's life, is no soft focus ode to motherhood. Lamott, who's a single mother and a recovering alcoholic, had to balance the joy of her son's birth with the loss of her lifelong best friend. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.